It's time for our annual fall movie preview. We'll cover the films we're excited about, the films you'll be hearing more about, and the films that might be picking up awards in the next few months.
Whether you like comedies or dramas, and whether you like to see your films in a theater or in the comfort of your own home, we're here to give you the scoop. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Stephen Thompson. On this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, we are looking ahead to the fall movie season. Here with me and Linda in the studio is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Stephen.
And in our fourth chair is NPR's film critic, Bob Mondello. Hello, Bob.
Good to be here.
Great to have you all here. Now, you three were at the Toronto International Film Festival earlier this month. Yeah. I was not. So I will be guiding this conversation, but not contributing to it in any useful or meaningful way.
Perfect.
But you saw a ton of movies. We've got a lot to get to. I'm going to start with you, Glenn. Give me one of the biggest and best movies that you saw.
Knives Out is a murder mystery with an all-star cast directed by Rian Johnson. It is purely fun. It is so purely genre, too. It is emphatically what it is. The cast is having a great time. You know, it's funny. Daniel Craig stars as the lead investigator, a guy by the name of Benoit Blanc. He's doing a ridiculous Southern accent. And there's another movie with a lead investigator doing a ridiculous accent with an all-star cast, The Murder on the Orient Express, that I don't want to see any more of, and they're making more of those films. I would see a million Daniel Craig as Benoit Blanc. He is having such a great time just chewing through the wainscoting.
It helps that everybody else in that movie is also chewing through the wainscoting. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is hilarious. She's one of the family members who may or may not be involved in the assassination of the patriarch. It is a crazy movie and enormous fun. It's sort of like Agatha Christie meets Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay. Knives Out. All right, how about you, Linda?
So one of my big favorites is called A Marriage Story. It's directed by Noah Baumbach, and it is done for Netflix, but it's going to be in theaters first. It stars Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, and essentially it's mostly a two-hander with them going through the end of their marriage and sort of how their breakup is going to work and what their divorce is going to feel like. It's one of the best films I've ever seen about divorce.
Yeah.
It's one of the most deeply compassionate, I think, toward both people. Adam Driver in particular is spectacular. Wow. And it is one of several films that I have seen or will see that make heavy use of Stephen Sondheim. So
yes.
What's not to like about that?
It is a recurring theme.
What's not to like about that? So I think that's going to be one to really watch. I think it's going to be awardsy, but it's also really accessible. And
Is it miserable?
Being compared a lot to Kramer versus Kramer.
Right.
I think there's some truth to that, yeah. Although I think the gender dynamics are different.
Yeah.
But it's and Laura Dern is in it as one of the divorce lawyers. It's very good.
It bubbles along with kind of low-key emotions, and you're wondering, where's the big Oscar clip for these guys? Mm-hmm. And then there's a big argument, and you're like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to see.
All right, Marriage Story. I will see it.
Yeah. I have another one for you, too.
Nice.
The next one on our list is called A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. As you might be able to guess, this is about Fred Rogers. This is Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers, which is even, I think, kind of a smarter casting choice than it originally seemed like it was. I think he does a really nice job of conveying how this guy is sort of an odd person in a lot of ways, but an important person in the life of this Esquire journalist based on a real Esquire journalist, played by Matthew Rhys. It is one of several films I saw at the festival based on magazine journalism. Mm-hmm. That seems to kind of be the big thing. This is based
Hustlers
on a
is
real,
too.
Hustlers is. There are several others. So I really thought it was very good. I think it's going to be a little more controversial probably than people originally expected because it's not a straight-up biopic. It's not a Fred Rogers biopic. It's really the story of the journalist and how Fred Rogers kind of comes into his life.
Yeah, I have to say at the very beginning, I was really worried about whether I was going to be able to take 2 hours of earnestness from Tom Hanks. And yet, after a couple of minutes, something happens. You're watching
That's the challenge of Fred Rogers, really, right? Is that overwhelming earnestness and whether you choose to find it corny to a point where you can't relate to it or not.
The director keeps holding these long shots of Hanks's face just staring at you. And you keep looking for a glint in the eye. You keep looking for something behind the performance. But all he's doing is projecting abject sincerity and kindness.
Oh,
and
so you must have not.
I dug it a lot.
Wow.
Director, by the way, that Glenn mentions is Marielle Heller, who
did Can You Ever Forgive Me,
which I really loved last year. So strong pedigree, more interesting than I think people expected. I liked it a lot.
And a movie that's going to divide people even more is Jojo Rabbit, which is the new film by Taika Waititi. It is about a young kid in Nazi Germany who idolizes Hitler and creates an imaginary friend, played by Taika Waititi, who is Adolf Hitler. This movie is so unabashedly, egregiously, gleefully goofy until the moment that it isn't anymore. And that tonal whiplash is going to set some people off. It didn't me. I totally bought the whole thing because, I mean, you know, there is a taste question, I suppose. But Nazis exist to be mocked. Nazis, this thinking can't just be ignored. It has to be called out. It has to be jeered at in the way that this film just takes the notion of here's their beliefs. We're going to stand them on their head and just mock the hell out of this thing for so long. Yeah. I really dug it.
Worked on you and also worked on the festival audience.
I was gonna
It won the Audience Choice Award, which has often been a harbinger of future award success. Green Book won it last year before going on to win Best Picture.
So what you're saying is that the movie where Hitler is this kid's imaginary friend is the new Green Book?
No, yeah.
I will say just briefly, I think there was not a film like that this year where there was quite as much dread that the film is really flawed but was going to be hugely successful and sweep up awards. I think Marriage Story was the second, was the runner-up to the Audience Award. It's all good, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And those two were followed up by Parasite,
yes,
which is a sensational movie, which was made by Bong Joon-ho. Mm-hmm. And he's the guy who made Snowpiercer and what was that horrible thing with the pigs? And I have liked but not loved his pictures in the past. This is an amazing satirical look at income inequality, which was a theme at the festival. I know that doesn't make it sound very interesting. It starts out as a sort of a comedy of manners and turns into, well, I don't want to say what it turns into. It is just an extraordinary movie. I mean, really powerful and wrenching and fabulous.
In preparing for this discussion, I read a review of that movie, and they had that same. And then it, well, I don't want to say anything.
See, that's the thing. I would go into it as fresh, as clean as you can, because it's full of reveals and reversals, and it builds to this remarkable conclusion, which is extremely cathartic, even though morally it shouldn't be. It's fascinating. Great stuff.
It's one of several we saw that kind of has a hard turn in the middle that it then becomes hard to talk about the movie because you don't want to break what the hard turn is, or even that there is one.
Right, exactly.
But it's an extraordinary film. Two families, one wealthy, one not.
So that was Parasite. Bob, you also saw a movie called Ford v. Ferrari?
Yeah, which I went to because it was getting such good word of mouth, and I would not otherwise have gone. It's got Matt Damon and Christian Bale. It's called Ford v. Ferrari, and it is about the Le Mans race of 1966, basically, and at the setup, Ford decides it wants to have a race car, and it has previously had sedans, right? And so when you get onto the racetrack now, I can't help seeing cars 2, 3, 4.
Right.
I mean, they all feel like that. But when they're not on the racetrack, those two guys are amazing. Matt Damon and Christian Bale are phenomenal together. And there's also a performance by Tracy Letts that's just guaranteed.
I love him.
He is guaranteed to get a Oscar nomination for about 30 seconds of film. And it's just gorgeous.
I'm so here for it. I think
it's really
he
cool.
is such a gem.
Yep.
Yeah. That's a true story. Also based on a true story is one of the other ones I wanted to talk about, which is called The Report. It comes from Scott Z. Burns, who's done a fair amount of directing and other work. But this is Adam Driver, largely an Adam Driver
driven
showcase, right? about the so-called torture report, which was investigated over the course of several years for one of the Senate committees about the activities that took place in interrogating suspects during the so-called war on terror. And so Annette Bening plays Dianne Feinstein. And so the two of them are really at the top of this film, along with John Hamm as a kind of a mid-level, disappointing. I will say, you know, Bob mentions he's an Obama guy. I think one of the things I appreciated about this film is that it has a very strong point of view about right and wrong and about the importance of this investigation. But it's not partisan in the sense that nobody comes off looking very good, except maybe this guy who completed this investigation. Other than that, what you really see are the limitations of power rather than the limitations and corruptions of power as opposed to of any particular party. And I think in the context of this film, that's handled in a very responsible way that I was grateful for. And again, Adam Driver, between this and Marriage Story, amazing festival for those of us who like Adam Driver.
Yeah. There's a new Pedro Almodovar film, Pain and Glory. You know, and he's doing something interesting now at this stage of his career. It stars Antonio Banderas as an aging filmmaker who's suffering from a variety of medical conditions. And recently, the Almodovar films were, you know, I'm So Excited, which was colorful and campy, as he's known for. Then he did Julieta, which is a return to his kind of dramatic, what he calls cinema of women. All his films feel personal. This feels deeply personal because he reconciles with this actor that he's been estranged from for a while. Apparently, that's the story of him and Antonio Banderas. He re-meets his first love. Now they've aged a little bit. It flashes back to his coming of age. It's really bittersweet. It's very assured, but it's surprising in a really satisfying way.
And yeah, again, that's called Pain and Glory.
Pain and Glory.
Yeah. I thought that was really great. It's oh.
All right, so that's Pain and Glory. Tell us about Uncut Gems.
Uncut Gems was I feel strange saying this. It is going to win Adam Sandler a Oscar.
I think that's very likely true.
It's an
at least it's very plausible.
It's a phenomenal performance in a film by Ben and Josh Safdie. They're known for making gritty independent pictures. In this one, they have a slightly higher budget, but he plays a character who is, in a way, like an Adam Sandler character in that he does stupid things, but this is how those stupid things might play out in real life with real life consequences. And it's really a devastating movie. He is spectacularly good and kind of like you cringe for him through the entire picture. Yeah. You sympathize with him because it's Adam Sandler and
This is an Adam Sandler movie. This is not a supporting.
Absolutely. It is an Adam Sandler special and it is guided.
not an Adam Sandler comedy special.
No, but it is an Adam Sandler project. And it is a performance that is big. And one of the things that happens sometimes with comedians when they are doing dramatic work, which he's done before, but one thing that can happen is that the performance can get very big and very showy. And it is big and showy, but it's also extremely smart. It is basically a film about a gem dealer, a jewelry store guy who is constantly trying to stay 30 seconds ahead of ruin from his gambling debts. It also features a surprisingly strong supporting performance from Kevin Garnett, the basketball player, playing himself.
Yeah.
It is a really good movie of a type that I don't always like, but I really, really liked it and respected it. And I think it's brilliantly done. Brilliantly.
It does seem, having seen none of the movies you're talking about, it does seem like an unusually strong movie coming out of this festival and kind of potentially a strong Oscar season.
I felt like it was.
I did too.
I felt like it was.
I was very pleasantly surprised by this festival because last year it didn't feel like that.
Yeah, and I felt like this year, even the ones that I didn't think were maybe spectacular were still really good. I felt like there were a lot that were just really good versions of the films that they were, whether or not I thought they were extraordinary.
With the single exception of Goldfinch. Which is terrible.
We talked about Goldfinch on this podcast.
Bob was
cinema sensation, the Goldfinch.
Should have waved you away.
So we've got our headliners from the festival. I'm going to go around the table and ask each one of you to give me one of your festival discoveries.
Sure. There's a Spanish film called The Platform, which doesn't have a release date yet, but it is about a future prison that's basically a tall tower with two inmates per level. And once a day, a platform descends from the top, loaded with food that kind of descends to the tower, stopping at each level for a few minutes. So the inmates at the top get lots of food. The inmates at the bottom have to fight each other for scraps. You might see the metaphor here.
It won the Midnight Madness thing, didn't it?
It certainly did. It's fantastic. I don't want to say too much about it because it is, again, filled with reveals and reversals, and you learn the rules of this universe kind of slowly. But what's remarkable is that while it is a metaphor, it doesn't abuse the metaphor because the film is the metaphor about capitalism, about income inequality. And the whole movie just works on that level. And it does something with it. It keeps innovating. Every few minutes, something happens to kind of do a twist on it, and it keeps upping the ante so it becomes a blistering satire of capitalism and consumerism. It is, I should warn people, very, very bloody, very gory, very brutal. Do not eat before, during, or after seeing this film. But it's a lot of fun. It's The Platform.
That's
look for it.
Service journalism.
Yes.
Thank you, Glenn. How about you, Linda?
So mine is a documentary that's called Collective, and it comes. It's a story out of Romania. If you like those stories where you get to really root for how amazing journalism is and can be, this is a great journalism story. It's basically about the first half is about the reporters who uncovered a gigantic scandal in the health system in Romania following the devastating nightclub fire that killed 27 people, but then 37 people later died in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And it set off this, why did so many people die in the hospital? And without giving too many details, the journalists at the Sports Gazette, which is a legit Romanian sports newspaper, but they have an investigative unit that they send off to just investigate whatever they come across. They wound up being the ones to uncover this enormous kind of series of cascading scandals. And then the back half of the film follows the newly chosen, after this all blows up, a new health minister is appointed. And you follow this young health minister who, rather than being a former hospital administrator, is a former patient's rights advocate, who has, therefore, a very different outlook on being health minister. So you follow him for the second half. I think that although the outlook on government is very, very dark in this film, in ways that I think are not specific to Romania, the outlook on journalism, it's one of those where you just really want to just keep being like, yeah, because these guys are just really dogged and really, it's a riveting story, but very, very sad. No release date yet, but this is the kind of documentary where eventually it's going to pop up somewhere streaming, where you can stream it. It's called Collective again, and I do recommend keeping an eye out. It's a terrific, terrific movie.
Nice. Thank you, Linda. How about you, Bob?
I always find that there is something that when there's a gap in my schedule, I go to accidentally, and it turns out to be really interesting. And this time it was Synonyms. It's a film about an Israeli who wakes up. He takes a trip to Paris. He wakes up in an empty apartment, naked, and tries to figure out how to stay in the country, how to do anything, really. I mean, even how to get out of the apartment. And he gets a pocket dictionary at some point and is wandering around the city saying all these French words, trying to be more French. And it sounds eccentric as hell. It's a really intriguing movie. And after a little while, I realized it's very literary in its way. It's going into all kinds of different directions. It becomes sort of an Ionesco-like farce. It's just it's a very weird and kind of wonderful movie. And there's no way, based on the description of it, that I would have gone in to see it. So it was just lucky that I had this gap in my schedule.
Nice. So Synonyms.
Synonyms.
All right. Thank you, Bob Mondello.
My pleasure.
So we're going to do another quick lightning round. These are just some of the other movies that popped into your line of sight that left an impression.
Yeah.
So, Glenn, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about Joker.
Yeah. Okay. So this is one of these films that we're going to do now that actually is going to get a lot of people talking. There will be a sea of think pieces about this film. It is a bravura performance from Joaquin Phoenix. It is brave. It is selfless. And that performance is in service of nothing. we'll talk more about it, but I wish this film had something, anything to say. It just doesn't. It's the origin story of the Joker, because people were clamoring, apparently. I just found it empty, self-satisfied, but it does have Shea Whigham and Bill Camp as a pair of police detectives. And I would watch those two dudes do anything. And we just proved that point because I watched them in this.
So looking forward to this movie.
I was not. But yeah, that's it. That's the Joker.
All righty. How about you, Linda?
I saw The Laundromat, which is the Steven Soderbergh directed, going to Netflix, film about the Panama Papers, which are all of the leaked documents that came to light about offshore companies and how people guard wealth from being found out. It's a lot like The Big Short. I thought the references to The Big Short were pretty obvious. As you recall, I didn't care for The Big Short. I didn't care for this either. Meryl Streep has a central role in it. There are a bunch of other people who kind of move through a series of vignettes. I think it's kind of forgettable, but I think there will be a lot of people who will take an interest in it, probably.
It's another one of those ones that I thought of as income inequality movies.
For sure.
And I saw a bunch of them, and it's an interesting movie. It's not, it isn't top of the line. You know, I wish it were.
Okay.
I saw Judy, which is the Judy Garland story, basically, with Renee Zellweger playing Judy, and I was frosted on it initially, and boy, did I end up liking the performance. I don't think the movie's very good, but there were moments where, especially when she starts singing at one point, I lost Renee Zellweger and was seeing Judy Garland. Wow. I swear I was. And she does all her own singing in it. And it's actually quite impressive as a performance. I think she's likely to get nominated for an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Glenn, what else you got?
The Lighthouse. This is Robert Eggers, who directed The Witch, shot this film in 35mm black and white about two lighthouse keepers who descended to madness on a remote outcrop of New England, some New England island as they tend a lighthouse. It is hallucinatory. It is feverish. It is moody. It is gorgeous to look at. And it is so wonderfully weird. It is totally, as the kids say, my poop. Willem Dafoe is serving you this crusty, flinty Yankee thing, and he's having a ball. But it's Robert Pattinson who actually takes a much bigger swing here with this Boston accent. So, yes, if you close your eyes, you can hear the Simpsons sea captain and having an argument with Mayor Quimby. But don't close your eyes, because this film is so beautiful and so weird.
Another one that I saw was Waves, which has had some buzz coming out of other festivals. It is a story about a family. It's directed by Trey Edward Schultz. It's a family with two teenagers. The father is played by Sterling K. Brown. The mother is played by Renee Elise Goldsberry. So that's very high kind of, you know, recognizability from those two very well-liked actors. The first half is kind of the story of the son who is struggling with a lot of different sources of pain. The back half, this is another one where the back half really takes a turn and it has some other things going on in it, and I don't want to say too much about it. It's a very, very artistically active film. So there's a lot going on. The score is very, very heavily present. This is another Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross score that just kind of pounds and is constant. But I actually didn't find it off-putting. There's a lot going on with spinning cameras. But I feel like the director knows always where you're supposed to be looking. And that what I think sets a film apart when it's shot that way. As long as I feel like I can always find the focal point, then I don't find it distracting for it to be shot that way. I think it's really terrific. It will not be everybody's cup of tea because it's just a lot. But I thought it was terrific. Terrific.
Linda, you also saw Harriet, the Harriet Tubman movie?
Yes. So Harriet Tubman is played here by Cynthia Erivo, who has, you know, came from Broadway and other films and Widows and stuff. It's also directed by Casey Lemons, who made Eve's Bayou and makes very, very beautiful films. I do think ultimately it's a biopic. It falls into a lot of traps of biopics. I think this is the one that I came out of and was sort of thinking, I have a feeling a lot of liberties were taken with the truth in this story. But I also think the Erivo performance is very good. I think, you know, obviously the story of Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad and some of those things are kind of always worth hearing again, even if the way they're told is not always perfectly effective.
Yeah, the performance is better than the script, but the performance is really impressive.
Yeah.
I'm realizing as we're talking about this that I saw a lot of biopics at this thing.
Yeah.
Harriet and Judy and Honey Boy, which is basically Shia LaBeouf writing a script about his own life and playing his own alcoholic father in it, which sort of, by the end of it, I mean, it's not actually a biopic per se, but it is. I mean, you're watching it and you're thinking, okay, I understand better Shia LaBeouf. And I also saw The Two Popes, which is about the two currently living popes. It imagines a dialogue between the two of them, and they are played by Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce. So trust me, it's amazing dialogue. I get the impression those guys could read the phone book and be just fascinating. Every once in a while here they have to be, because it was written by the guy who wrote Bohemian Rhapsody. But seriously, it's a lot of biopicdom to take in.
I've been seeing trailers a lot for Motherless Brooklyn.
Yes, Motherless Brooklyn I saw about a month and a half ago and liked quite a bit until Glenn told me why I shouldn't.
No. You like to tell people what it's about.
Ed Norton's passion project, basically. Right. It's a novel about a detective with Tourette's who is trying to solve a series of incidents in New York, including the murder of a guy he was working with. And he gets into what in the novel was apparently Chinese gangs, and in the movie is a municipal finessing by a guy who's rather like Robert Moses, the guy who built the Cross Bronx Expressway and all kinds of other things, and who is used to tearing down housing projects. I thought that the change from the novel to what they're doing in the film was kind of interesting. I think it's Ed Norton trying to do Chinatown.
Right, that's basically what it seems like.
Yeah. And it's an I thought it was a really interesting picture, and then Glenn explained to me why I shouldn't like it.
No. I mean, I just wasn't feeling it. I mean, it felt to me like an Edward Norton vanity project. I felt it was overlong and convoluted, but not surprising in any way. It's like, what if somebody besides the Coen brothers made Miller's Crossing? You know, what if you took that film and took all the style out of it? What you have left is Motherless Brooklyn.
Okay. Linda, you had one more.
Yeah, I want to close out by when I mentioned earlier that a lot of the ones that I saw that weren't even like maybe the absolute best movie ever were just really good and really good versions of the films that they were. One that I would mention is called Just Mercy. It is also based on a true story of an attorney who works very closely with death row inmates. It stars Michael B. Jordan as the attorney, Jamie Foxx as his primary client, and Brie Larson as kind of his assistant, the other woman who's working with him with the attorney at this project that he sets up to assist these men who are on death row. You know, I think that it has some cliched moments. It has some sort of courtroom, you know, kind of courtroom grandiosity that's not real. Mm-hmm. But the performances are excellent. Jamie Foxx is very good here. It doesn't feel like too much of a kind of Oscar pleading or another Oscar pleading from him or from Jordan. I think they're both excellent in it. It also winds up being a very, very impassioned argument against the death penalty in general, even for people who are guilty. It's a fascinating film, great performances, but also a lot of interesting ideas about the death penalty in opposition to it.
Thank you, Linda. Now, this is our fall movie preview. It is not comprehensive by any means. There are many movies we have not had a chance to screen that have maybe in some cases not been screened for anybody yet. We haven't seen Dolomite Is My Name with Eddie Murphy as Dolomite, Terminator, Dark Fate, The Irishman, which is the big Scorsese movie, Frozen 2, Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, Cats, Little Women, many, many
cats.
Movies
oh,
we
cats.
Will be discussing in the months to come. They haunt me already. Before we move on, this is an excellent time, I think, in our fall movie preview to revisit our summer box office predictions our summer movie preview. We did a round robin with Aisha Harris. We predicted which movie was going to make the most money and which was going to be the biggest boondoggle of the summer. Making the most money, Glenn, you picked Avengers Endgame. That was a layup.
That was a no-brainer.
That was pretty easy. More than $800 million in the U.S., $1.9 billion internationally. Highest grossing film of all time.
So now, that's a win?
That would be a win.
Yes, but let me point out, this is something I'm forever saying and everybody gets annoyed with. If you adjust for inflation,
sure.
It is not the movie that was seen by the most people by a lot.
Inflation.
Domestically, just in this in North America, it ranks number 16 mm-hmm. in terms of attendance. So, that's after Gone with the Wind. That's after 101 Dalmatians. It's after a lot of things that you don't really think about as being these monsters. But it made the most money because now you pay a lot of money and you see it in 3D and or some other form that allows them to charge extra. So it made a fortune.
Well, it came out the longest ago of any of these movies.
Also
and
that.
So adjusted for inflation, it is the highest grossing film of the summer. Glenn,
me.
You win. Linda picked The Lion King. That came in second with $530 million domestic, $1 billion internationally, $1.6 billion total. Very good pick. Aisha picking third. You'll notice we picked these in a certain order. Mm-hmm. We came in 1-2. Aisha came in third with Toy Story 4, made over $400 million domestically, over $600 million internationally, more than $1 billion total. And I got the lonely fourth pick, and I picked Spider-Man Far From Home, which made almost $400 million domestically, more than $700 million internationally, $1.1 billion total. Not a bad pick either for the guy picking fourth. Thank you very much. For biggest boondoggle, Aisha Harris picked first. She picked Dark Phoenix, which made about $250 million worldwide, but only $65 million in the U.S., that would be a flop for a movie that cost a lot more than that. I think it's fair to say that was indeed a disappointment, if not an outright catastrophic boondoggle. Glenn, you picked Godzilla King of the Monsters, which made $110 million in the U.S. That is not massive for a movie like this.
I would not say boondoggle, though. I mean, it just came and went and did not leave a ripple.
It came and went here. It made $385 million total internationally. Not a catastrophic bomb. I picked Artemis Fowl.
That's the good
which
one.
Which was scheduled to come out in early August and moved to May 2020, which means I'm picking it again next year. I think that was, I choose to believe that was an excellent pick.
Yep.
Linda, you picked Aladdin, not a flop, more than $300 million domestically, almost $700 million internationally, a little more than $1 billion total. It did well, but I also think you were saying compared to what it could do.
Well, and I think I was also, I give myself a point for the fact that I still think nobody will care about it 3 years from now,
right,
other than children who watch it 4,000 times. I do think it made not a ripple in the actual world and the cultural conversation.
Yeah.
So I stand by my pick, even though it was wrong.
All right. Well, there you go. There you have it. That wraps up our fall movie preview. Tell us what you think about this slate of fall movies. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it'll be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Spotlight. Spotlight is your destination for curated expert content that helps you discover how beauty and medical aesthetic treatments may fit into your routine. In addition to offering reviews, insider profiles, and fact-check stories, Spotlight helps users find licensed providers in their area with a database of over 30,000 local healthcare professionals. Learn more about the latest trends and research at thespotlight.com/happyhour.
Support also comes from Zoom. Zoom is used by millions to connect face-to-face across town or around the world. Zoom ties together all of your unified communication tools into one easy platform for video conferencing, phone calls, group chat, webinars, and conference rooms. Zoom is how business gets done. Visit Zoom online to set up your free account today. Meet happy with Zoom.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week. And every week, what is making us happy this week? Linda Holmes, what's making you happy this week, buddy?
Stephen Thompson, as you know, I recently acquired a new vehicle.
Yes, you did.
And as you may also know, I am currently going through the pop culture experience of owning a new car, which is it comes with satellite radio.
Yep.
So what is making me happy this week is my exploration of satellite radio, whether it is your standard stuff, your Beatles channel,
mm-hmm.
your Howard Stern, your Netflix comedy now has its own satellite radio channel. But more to the point, what really is thrilling is trying to figure out what on earth is behind some of the channels that they come up with. And you sit there and you think, I don't know whose taste this is, but clearly it is someone's taste. Now, one that I paid attention to the other day is called Road Trip.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that Road Trip would be some kind of booming, like, Road Trip music.
Road Trip songs.
But I turned it on the other day and it was Phil Collins' Take Me Home. And I was like, I don't understand.
That is about a journey to one's home.
Exactly.
Sometimes you make that in your car.
And what I'm telling you is, all across satellite radio, you find stations where you think, this is someone's baby.
Oh, yeah.
And all you can do is sit there, you see what comes up on the station, and you try to get inside the mind of whose Road Trip is this? It's like, sure, Sheryl Crow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Uh-huh. Got it. Phil Collins, Take Me Home. Hmm. Is that a Road Trip song? Is that a Windows Down banger? I don't know.
For seventh grade Glenn, it was.
But the but the point is, I'm very much enjoying the journey into the minds of satellite radio programming.
All right. Thank you very much, Linda Holmes. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
I've got two kind of tongue-in-cheek how-to books. The first is by Randall Monroe. People will know him from the webcomic XKCD. It's called How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. And it is exactly that. It's needlessly, hilariously complex, overcomplicated instructions for doing things like taking a selfie or playing tag. The other one is called How To Invent Everything: A Survival Guide for the Stranded Time Traveler. That's by Ryan North, and everybody should just save themselves a lot of time and worry and just get everything that Ryan North does. He's great. It starts from the premise that you find yourself stranded in the distant past, and you need to know how to build civilization. So, how to develop a written language, how to farm, how to build a steam engine. Both of these books are very funny, but what I like about them is that there's real information in both of them. There's learning that happens, and that's fun whenever that can happen. So those are two books, How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems, and How To Invent Everything: A Survival Guide for the Stranded Time Traveler.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what's making you happy this week?
I got steeped last week in Downton Abbey, and as a result of that, I started thinking about Hugh Bonneville and saw him on a show called W1A and remembered how much I loved that and realized there was an entire season still that I hadn't seen. It's essentially about the BBC. It is about how the BBC operates, as a result of which it is about any media organization, like, for instance, NPR. So I'm sitting there and looking at it and feeling like I'm at meetings at NPR, but they are hilarious. Here is one in which Hugh Bonneville, as the head of values, and nobody quite knows what that means there, including him, as the head of values, is heading a meeting in which the PR person has decided to completely reinvent the BBC because nobody watches television.
I mean, I can see where you're going with this.
You so cannot.
But just to inject a note of reality for a moment, I mean, nearly 9 million people are watching Happy Valley at the moment.
Okay.
I mean, okay, it's not Morecambe and Wise anymore.
Okay, so I didn't even know what that is, okay?
No, but still, it's a lot of people, that's all.
Okay, so I'm talking about the future here, right?
Well...
Okay, and you're talking about the past.
I'm talking about last Wednesday.
Okay. So, I totally love this show. Everything about it is hilarious.
And how do we watch this?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's on Netflix.
W1A?
W1A.
Thank you very much, Bob Mondello. Now, Linda, at the top of this segment, you mentioned listening to SiriusXM in your car. My SiriusXM subscription expired about 5 years ago. I've had in my car for the last few weeks the self-titled debut by a country music supergroup called The High Women. If you have not yet heard The High Women, it is Brandi Carlile, Maren Morris, Amanda Shires, and Natalie Hemby. Natalie Hemby's a great songwriter who's written for Miranda Lambert, among others. It's kind of in the spirit of like Trio or the Pistol Annies.
The Highwaymen.
And the Highwaymen, but specifically a version of the Highwaymen with women. And actually the album opens with a song called Highwaymen. It is this beautiful telling of the different stories of women throughout history. It is absolutely gorgeous. Let's actually hear just a little piece of it.
We are the daughters of the silent generation. You send our hearts to die alone in foreign nations. It may return to us as tiny drops of rain, but we will still remain. And we'll come back again and again.
God, if you have not spent time with this record, I think a lot of people listening have already spent time with this record, but if you haven't, you owe it to yourself. It is wonderful. It's one of the albums of the year. We'll be talking about it more come Grammy season, I'm guessing. The High Women. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Linda at Linda Holmes. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Bob at Bob_Mondello. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katz. At Mike Katziff, that's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And we will see you all right back here next week.
Hi there, I'm Felix Contreras, host of NPR Music's Alt Latino podcast. Every fall, many people around the country celebrate Latino Heritage Month. And while we like to say every month is a Heritage Month in our program, we still like to do something extra special. Intrigued? Listen and subscribe to Alt Latino from NPR and join the fun.